Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Welcome to Face to Face. This is a show about change and about what's next. It's a show that wants to ask questions, peel back the layers of our average everyday experience, and go beyond scratching the surface. We interview amazing people with incredible ideas and stories who have done wild, weird, and wonderful things. Remember that imagination shared creates collaboration, and collaboration creates community, and community inspires social change. I'm David Peck, and this is Face to Face.
Well, welcome to Face to Face. We're joined by two very special guests here today, all the way from Pittsburgh. And we're going to hear a little bit about that city, probably, I would think. But more importantly, we're going to talk about Adventures in Memory, a new book by Hilda and Ylva Ostby, both joining us here today live on Skype. Welcome and thank you for your time today to the two of you. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you so much.
So The Science and Secrets of Remembering and Forgetting is the subtitle, Adventures in Memory. Where you guys, why don't you lead the conversation here a little bit? Tell me where we should begin. Do we begin with the sea monster? Where do we start?
Yeah, we can begin with the sea monster, or the hippocampus, as it's called, which we focus on, and which is portrayed as a seahorse on the cover of our book, because the hippocampus is a very vital part for memory formation in the brain.
And what and it looks like a seahorse. It's the shape of a seahorse. Is the metaphor go any deeper than that?
No, it was kind of discovered by a guy in Bologna in 1564. Julius Caesar Arancy, he was called, and he found this structure in the brain that he thought looked a little bit like a sea monster, which could look like anything in those days, but afterwards it's been called the hippocampus name has gone over to the seahorse, so it's kind of a seahorse structure. And they didn't know anything about it until in 1953, when a guy called
Henry Mollison.
Mollison, which I never remember how to pronounce. Mm. He was operated on and he lost both of his hippocampi. And it's like the kidneys. You can take one and you can have a totally similar life almost. But if you take both, then it affects you deeply. So it affected him deeply to lose both of his hippocampi, and so he lost the ability to form new memories forever.
Yeah. Well, and Henry was participating in a lot of memory studies, so that's why he got kind of famous in the history of neuroscience. Initially known only as HM by his initials, but after his death in 2008, his full identity was disclosed, and he kind of got the honor that he deserved for showing the rest of us how important the hippocampus is for laying down memories.
Of course, he didn't remember any of the things he did for science.
Yeah,
which is so comically ironic and tragic in its own way.
Yeah.
So before we go deeper into that, because I do want to talk about HM, as you have now affectionately referred to him as, tell me a little bit about your story. Your sister's one of you, the history of ideas. Is that right? Somebody has a master's degree in that or a PhD in that? Yeah. That's amazing.
No, master's degree. I was working with Shakespeare and The Tempest and kind of ideas on alchemy. At the time. And at the time, the art of memory was one of the dark arts and related to alchemy. And one of the kind of most famous alchemists of the time, Robert Fludd, was writing a book about the art of memory. So many people believe that Shakespeare was influenced by these ideas. And of course, that comes into his play, The Tempest, where an alchemist is the main character. But later on, many years later, that came into play when we started writing this book about memory.
Why?
Yeah,
why?
It's like nice to think of memory as gold, you know, like the alchemists were trying to make gold, but memory is also like a precious thing.
What? Why was it considered? You say dark arts. Why was it sort of considered? Was it sort of this mysterious edge to it, or I mean, alchemy too was very connected to magic, really, wasn't it?
Yeah,
in many respects, right? So, can you talk a little bit about that dark art-like edge?
It was, of course, because of the magic of things appearing in the mind.
Right.
And Robert Fludd compared the memory to the scene in a theater, in a theater building, and many believes that the globe, which was Shakespeare's theater, was built as a memory machine based on Robert Fludd's principles of how memory works. So we were there in the book, we write about that and how you could see the whole kind of zodiac in the ceiling on stage, actually. The actors could see the zodiac in the ceiling, and they could use that as a mnemotechnic, which is the same as a memory palace. We talk about that too in the book, but memory palace is from ancient time, from antiquity. They learned speeches like that. They learned it as a kind of traveling in a house or just on the road, and then you place all your points along those points, kind of along those highlights on that route, and then you can pick up the points as you speak. So that is maybe what happened in Shakespeare's theater as well, that the actor would place all of their, you know, everything they needed to remember, they would place it along the zodiac, which is 12 signs. So then you can take that 12 highlights of the play and just try and remember it connected to the zodiac,
right,
as
right.
a memory tool.
Well, what's so interesting to me about that is the unknown of the stars, the unknown of what lies beyond, and yet the memory very much the same in a way, isn't it? Isn't it kind of interesting
that
the metaphor, there's so many similarities between that. In fact, I think near the end of the book, and I'm not quite finished, and by the way, congratulations on a wonderful read and a great book, and I hope everybody reads it. It's a fascinating read on so many levels. So let's talk a little bit more about this mystery. Neuropsychology and literature come together. You're sisters, but you're also clearly, you've approached this from a historical and an academic perspective as well. So it's a really nice mix. Can you talk a little bit about that? which sister goes first?
I'm the neuropsychologist.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, first, I have to say that after studying memory from a kind of this neuropsychological, neuroscientific perspective for many, many years, I have learned so much more while reading this book and kind of embracing this wide perspective on memory. So just acknowledging that memory is about everything from the molecular level and up to society and history. And literature, and I think that is yes, very interesting. So so we combine forces in that we explore these the scientific issues of memory, and we do so also through literary storytelling, because as my sister is a writer and author, she has all these good tricks up her sleeve and her artistic background to make this happen and make it come more alive.
It's kind of we always did the same thing. I realized that I studied history, and history is our collective memories. That is very very unique to humankind, that we collect our memories together and make stories out of them and share them with generations after us. That is something that other species don't do, as we know, as far as we know, that we tell the stories again and again, and now we know what happened in Mesopotamia 2,500 years ago. That is amazing. And also kind of as a writer, I suddenly realized that all the tools I have as a writer is just the right of memory, or how the memory works, that it's just an echo of how the brain is structuring our memories.
You know, it's
how we tell stories.
It's amazing. I love the link between collective memories and storytelling. So as Ylva, as a neuropsychologist, is it important for you for memories to be accurate, for me to remember well? I would think as a storyteller, it's not as important. But you're you're the scientist, right? 2 + 2 = 4, right? Do you know where I'm going with that?
Actually, memories are not that reliable anyway. So
right.
We hope that the science about memory is reliable, but the memories themselves are highly unreliable. And that is because they are reconstructions. So they are partly based on actual memory traces in the brain, you know, these physical changes that take place between neurons when they strengthen the synapses, which is what happens on a cellular level when you learn something. But the memory is so much more than just a replay of those memory traces. So when we reconstruct a memory, we kind of also enter into it our imagination and fill in the gaps and make it a kind of fluid experience, even though we don't get to keep all the details of a memory.
Our memories is like the Shakespearean theater, where every performance is a little bit different. And the hippocampus is the director, and he's a really bad director too, because it's kind of everything can happen. People are stumbling into stage in the wrong underwear and just say the wrong lines, and it's not the not what happened. It's it's a really bad reenactment, I would say, all the time.
So how does that impact? And we've got, and you talk about it in the book as well, this idea of false memory. And I remember 20 or 30 years ago, that was very big. It was being used in some circles as a, almost as a cop out, as an excuse, you know what I mean? Like, I remember it this way. Well, so I just wonder how our identities are connected to our memory. And I think of, what if, you know, you did an experiment with me, which you couldn't do, I suppose, but we went back in time.
We could try it.
Yes. And you went back
totally
in time.
Unscientific experiment.
That's right. Yes. This is the stuff of science fiction, I think, but maybe not. You tell me different here, but slowly erase my memories.
Yes.
And don't you slowly erase the person that I am? Talk to me about my identity and I think before the recorder was on, we already shared kind of a love for the film Blade Runner. I mean, memories make us human, right?
Let me tell you the story of Arne first, and then the inner
cut. Arne is a Norwegian name,
and he's my friend, and he is a very successful person. He has written two books now, and he's participated in several albums by a very famous rock group in Norway, toured all over the world, got awards for everything. And he is married with two children. Mm-hmm. And when he knew that I was writing a book about memory, he said, is it normal, Hilda? I just want to know, is it normal to not remember anything about my past, my childhood and youth? And I said, yeah, you know, childhood amnesia, because we all can't remember, being born and right. Years after, luckily, so that's normal up to the age of 7. But he said, no, it's not about that, I don't remember anything. And then we interviewed him in this book, and he can't remember his first kiss or how his vacations were, and he don't have any vivid memories, like
right.
We always talk about memories as this kind of movie in our head. But he, of course, knows that it happened. He has this kind of what we call semantic memory,
sure.
The kind of the story, but he don't have this reenactment in his head about it. And it goes back kind of 10 years in his life. So after 10 years, things start to fade for him. Actually, on this tour, we met this woman, and she said she couldn't remember anything vividly, like we were talking about in our talk. It was in another city in Canada, and she said, but I don't remember those things, but I know that it happened, and I got the pictures, and
right.
I kind of remember the pictures, and it really made me sure that, and also this science shows that what you test when you test a person's personality isn't what they remember of their lives, because that would be a very strange personality test. What you test is how you react to the world, how you respond, how you process things, but not how much you remember, because everyone remembers differently and we have a different set of stories. It's very individual, actually.
And also,
and you can be very happy and don't remember anything.
Yeah, and while reading Suzanne Corkin's book about HM, it kind of struck me how HM, with his profound and retrograde amnesia, he was kind of lost in the here and now, in the moment, but he still had a personality and a sense of self and a sense of identity, even though he had to look in the mirror to know that he had aged.
So it's the frontal lobes that makes the personality change, isn't it?
Well, personality is made up of many different brain systems together with our experience with the world.
Because it's a mystery. But one thing that would really change your personality is...
Yeah, so the personality, how you act and how you react, etc., is, of course, mostly impacted by frontal lobe damage.
If that you would kind of...
So what about...
You wouldn't get that many friends with would be difficult.
No, we can't say that, because a lot of people have frontal lobe damage, and we can't say that they can't have friends. That's cruel.
Right. You may not have friends. Yes.
Yeah. No. It's it may be difficult, like with impulse control and stuff like that.
So are you saying then it's more about the experience? It's more about how you respond to something. Whether it's not important that you remember it. It's how you're, and maybe this is a nice sort of segue into this idea of body memory. Where does that come into play? Or phenomenology would teach us that it's mind and body. We're experiencing everything. It's when you're looking at me on the screen, I'm looking at you on the screen, and but I'm also experiencing what's going on behind me. I can maybe hear my kids in the basement. I can hear wind blowing outside, right? That's all a part of it too, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, and what people call bodily memories are usually, scientifically speaking, these memories are also stored in the brain, but they are not made explicit. So they are only experienced by using the body. So the way we move and the way we perform skills and the way we react emotionally to various situations feels like it is grounded in our body, because that's how it is kind of remembered through the use of our body. So that's a totally different memory system that is separate from the hippocampal explicit memory system.
But it's an advantage to kind of use your body when you try to remember something, isn't it?
Because
just in Norway, they tried out this system in one school, just learning children math while running up and down a hill. And to me, that sounds kind of both a little bit crazy, but also very sensible, because you will remember it much better, right?
Yeah. And
you will create a bigger system of...
A more active memory network, because all these memories are laid down in neuronal networks, and these networks can be connected to other networks and bigger networks, etc. And being able to form a big and elaborate network with many sensory entry points is beneficial for later recall.
Are you so? A little personal story here. I'll see the odd photo from time to time. I have a 13-year-old son, Spencer, and I have a 11-year-old daughter, Victoria. And every now and then, I'll see a photo, and I'll say to Elizabeth, my wife, I have no memory of that. I have zero recollection of that. And then she'll start talking about it in a particular way. In fact, we were at the Washington Zoo just this past summer in D.C., and Elizabeth and I had been there with our family 5 or 6 years before, and we're walking through the zoo, and I'm saying, and I'm not kidding, I was saying, if a gun had been put to my head, I would have said this emphatically. I said, no, we've never been here before. We have, and you know what it was? We had come in from a different entrance. So we had come in from the north entrance and not the south entrance. And soon as we hit this one, there was a bridge. And soon as we hit this bridge, I went, okay, I now know I've been here before. And it was like something triggered, and then, okay, I remember that restaurant, and I remember going to the washroom over there, and I remember we parked the car. That's fascinating to me, right?
That's so
it's all there, right? It's all there somewhere.
You kind of had to find the right entry point.
I had to find the right. Well, that's what made me think of it. And I think the question I want to ask you is, and I've got lots of them, but I think, are you guys worried at all that when I see a photo of my daughter or my son and I say, I have no recollection of that, are you worried about that in any way?
No, not at all.
Does it bother you as a novelist or as a scientist?
I have the same story. I was in a vacation spot in Greece, and then I was in this small town, and we decided to go up on the mountain and just to explore. And then we went down from the mountain, and we were like, "Wow, it's another village here. It's really nice."
That's so
funny.
Wow,
it's so fascinating here. And then, it's the same village as we came from. We just came in from a different angle.
No, I'm not worried.
Did that have anything to do with all the drinking you had been doing the night before? Or? No? No?
No. But of course you won't remember. And so many moments you don't have to remember. You have to just remember the feeling of it. One summer vacation, that is one feeling. And then you have some moments that kind of stands out, right? That are kind of, that happened.
Yeah,
I know.
Sure.
I was happy then. But mostly it's kind of this, because we have the memory works in two very conflicting ways. The one is memory loves everything that stands out, like everything that is exceptional and very strongly emotional. Hmm. And the other is it tries to kind of pack everything down like in a suitcase. Because our mind isn't, limitless. Right. So you have to pack it down into a suitcase as tightly as possible, and then it disappears into this feeling of a nice summer. That is just one memory, kind of made up of 20 nice summer days.
Right, right.
Mm. Like so that isn't strange.
So I guess... Are there lessons to be learned here? Do people read, or takeaways from Adventures in Memory, your new book, are some of the takeaways that, we want to create better memories, we want to take more photographs, we want to spend more time in the moment. You know, these are some of the things that I've been kind of thinking about because, even as I watched my father, struggling with Parkinson's disease and different types of medication, and he would be accessing memories and things and stories that I had never heard about, when he was in the hospital. And then once the medication was taken away, all of that kind of dissipated and disappeared. And so it just, these experiences remind me, I suppose, of, wow, at my age, I got to be way more present than I currently am. Anyway, I'm not sure that's what you guys are trying to advocate here for, but well, I'd love to hear more about that. What are some of the lessons,
We want people to kind of cherish the memories that they get to have, but also to simply accept that we won't be able to keep all those precious moments with us. And that is okay. It is not... While some people do have the fascinating ability to remember what they have done every day for their whole life, most of us do not. And there is nothing we can do to make us into these kind of super mnemonic machines or anything. But we do have this fascinating and magical ability to recreate the past. So that, for instance, when my husband tells me that I had this wonderful experience with him at a restaurant someplace, and I have no recollection of that at all. And I have to kind of simply accept that he remembers it and I don't. But I can get this, while he tells me the story, I get to imagine how it was and make reconstruction of it.
It was kind of an eye-opener for me when Ylva said, and we write this in the book, that kind of we talk about collected memories, like, the collected memory of a summer, or just all the times you take the bus to work, that is a collected memory. Or
I think we call it a cumulative memory.
Where you just pile them up together and make one memory out of them. And she talks about how she has such a memory of her hugging her son. And that is all the time she hugged her son and just sniffed his hair. And I think that is beautiful, we kind of strive for that unique, exceptional moment that we want to remember, but that cumulative memory is also worthwhile, you know. That is also something magical about that.
Well, you know,
so we have to start. And also, I kind of to add something that I've been doing yoga for so many years and kind of strive for this presence that they always talk about.
Yeah, for sure. I understand.
Yeah, and kind of mindfulness and all that. And then I learned from this that our kind of the relaxed mode of the brain is to go back and forth in time. You remember something, you think of tomorrow, you think of next summer, you go back again. Your wildly associative brain is like that when it's relaxing. And I was so relieved to hear that. I was like, oh, no more mindfulness for me.
I do meditative yoga. I totally understand. I love the phrase wildly associative brain, because it just seems like lunacy when you're trying to relax and you're going, how have I ever survived as a human being? This is ridiculous. This is right. It's
you cannot stay in the moment.
It's so hard. I love your phrase about, you know, memory loves everything that stands out. And for me, as I get older, as I read, as I watch more film, as I spend more time with my family, I think that to me is an argument for staying in the moment. If memory loves things that stand out, then you got to make the moment stand out in some significant way. And it might just mean listening better. It might mean looking into your son or daughter's eyes when you're talking to them, or holding your wife's hand or your partner's or whatever. Yeah. Right. And I think that's a wonderful, wonderful thing. Can I ask you guys a little bit about, you know, you talk about PTSD, you talk about trauma, you talk about, you know, we talked a little bit also before the recorder was on about another favorite film of mine, Memento, you know, and Guy Pearce's character has this, we think, some sort of traumatic experience, which then doesn't allow him to remember anymore. Is there a way to attend to that kind of a thing? Can you, you know, through your research, through your writing and so on, your experience, is there a therapy for that? Is there a skill, you know, to I don't know, to get people back to where they were? Does that make any sense at all?
Well, in the film Memento, we don't know if he has a physical damage or if he has experienced some kind of psychogenic amnesia.
Right.
So, but psychogenic amnesia is very rare, and it is not a usual reaction to trauma. So what most people experience in the face of trauma is very strong memories. So they remember the traumatic episode painfully well, and it sticks and comes back at them uninvited. Right. Uninvited a lot of times during the day and by the kind of by being exposed to these triggers in the environment. Right. Being able to live with that kind of recurring traumatic memories is a big challenge for people. And of course, through therapy, one tries to make people soften the emotional impact of the memory to the extent that it is acceptable to know that they will come back. So.
Right.
So in the book, we talked to one of the survivors of the Utøya massacre in Norway in 2011.
Right.
And he told us very vividly how these memories of being shot by the terrorists and seeing his friends being shot in front of him, how all these memories were they were controlling his life. And that is important to remember, because these are symptoms that can't be seen on the outside by other people.
Right.
So people who are war veterans or have been raped or held at gunpoint or other kinds of traumatic experiences, they have these inner symptoms that are so disturbing, and people don't see that from the outside.
Yeah, so they should know what how that affects these people, and it's so many for so many reasons, mm-hmm. like refugees or Me Too victims or anything, and then it affects your memory so bad because you get you're not concentrated when you're constantly attacked by these memories. So that will kind of affect everything in your life.
Yeah,
right?
It will affect the new memories, the kind of everyday memory, and also people will try to ward off memory in general too, because remembering anything might entail the risk of remembering the trauma.
Well, it makes me wonder, you know, if some things are better forgotten.
Yes, of course it is. We are strong advocates of forgetting. Although it has to be said that remembering the traumatic event that happened to you is important for other reasons, of course, but having to remember it so strongly is what we want to, or what one tries to alleviate during therapy.
Right.
But not only that, but Ylva did this experiment where she tried to remember it 100 days in a row. And to me, at least, I don't know for Ylva, but I think that sounded really, really boring. Like, so many things you don't want to remember, like, you know, just brushing your teeth
right,
you remember, right?
Yes. Yeah. I was sort of thinking more about like old painful relationships. That's where I was going.
Yeah.
not how many times I brush my teeth a day, you know. Yeah.
Yes. Both of those.
Yeah, that's right. Yes.
Yeah. Easily forgotten. Should be forgotten.
Easily forgotten.
Is a good medicine.
And it is, I didn't know that when I started working with this book, but it's no kind of either or. It's not either a good memory or a bad memory. Kind of people that remember well and people that don't remember. It is all shades and colors of memory. And there are people that have what you call highly
superior
autobiographical
memory.
Yeah. And they,
we
don't have that. But they can remember every single day of their life 50 years back. And then what researchers found was that they tend to hold grudges.
Interesting. That's pretty interesting.
That's strange. Yeah. If you remember everything vividly, then someone, you know, kicking you on the leg or something, that will stick really well for a long time. And that is not a good thing.
Well, it's interesting, you know, it's an interesting, it seems to me it's an interesting comment on behaviorism really too, in a sense, and just psychology and forgiveness as well. I mean, these are all other avenues for this conversation, but we recently got a dog, a rescue from Greece.
Yeah.
And we live just outside of Toronto. And I would say for the first 4 to 6 weeks, her name is Sasha. She's maybe 3 or 4 years old. Her memories, I would imagine, of her former life were not allowing her to really step into our home. You know, she was really timid and skittish and just didn't want to go downstairs. And still, there's certain things she won't do. And that's got to be, you know, I mean, that's a defense mechanism, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so she's not holding a grudge against us. She's just being careful. No. She's just being wise, right?
And she's traumatized probably.
And she's probably traumatized as well. Yeah, no, for sure. It's, listen, you know, we're going to have to wrap it up shortly, sadly. And I really enjoyed having a conversation with you guys about this book. You must have come across some pretty interesting people along the way. I did an interview a couple of weeks ago with Bridget Delaney on her new book Wellmania, and at the end of her book she thanks all the eccentric people that she met along the way, and I wondered, you know, other than, you know, is there somebody that stands out for you guys that you can remember that touched you in a way that made you realize how important this project was and why you were moving forward with it. Anyone stand out?
Yeah, well, Hilde has already mentioned Arne, our friend who couldn't remember his childhood. And we have mentioned Adrian, the survivor of the
yes.
Utøya shooting, which was really, he really gave so much of his story to show how memory works in the case of trauma. And also what stood out for me was when we talked to this guy who calls himself Wind, who had suffered from retrograde amnesia at the age of 27. And so he had kind of wiped out all of his memories up until that age. And while that is so traumatic, just going through that, he was very, he had come to peace with it. And he had, through the help of friends and family, he had kind of reconstructed his past and tried to imagine how these episodes might have been experienced by himself by just listening to them. But he kind of reminded us that while he has this gigantic black hole in his memory, we all have kind of these smaller black holes in our memories, even though we don't have retrograde amnesia. So we don't remember everything that has happened to us. We can't have complete control of the past. Mm.
What a great way to end our conversation. Thank you so much to you both, Ylva and Hilda Usby, talking about their new book, Adventures in Memory, The Science and Secrets of Remembering and Forgetting. Really appreciate your time today, you two. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having us. Such a pleasure. Thank you.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.